Good morning, diners and travelers of the world. Welcome to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We're going to start off this show with, good morning, Peter.
I'm easily forgotten. Easily overlooked. But our
listeners, he's unforgettable. What you are.
But our first guest is absolutely unforgettable.
He's fabulous.
One of just the nicest guys, and also one of the best chefs in these United States, hailing from the city of New Orleans, which is outside of which city he was born. And he's chosen to celebrate that after 5.5 years of work with a wonderful cookbook and book of reminiscences.
Well, he didn't work 5.5 years. It took 5.5 years of work to write this book.
Well, no, that's what I meant.
Yeah, but he celebrates it all the time with his restaurant empire.
I thought I made that clear. Obviously, I did not make it clear, but he tried to offload writing the book to somebody else, and she promptly gave it back to him and said, "No, you have to write this book." And we are so glad.
Johnny boy. Let's listen to the interview.
We're just so glad that he took the 5.5 years to do that, because the result is an extraordinary book, and the interview is an extraordinary interview.
Well, I'm so thrilled to be talking to John Bash again. It's been a long time. Welcome to On the Menu, John.
Well, it's great to have a chance to talk to y'all.
New Orleans this year.
I know, we miss you down here.
Yeah.
And I know you might not even notice the difference, because we've had the coldest cold snap. Now, down here, it lasts for a matter of days, maybe a couple of weeks at the most. But we felt like we've had your Pennsylvania weather.
Yeah, well, I guess
I can assure you we kept plenty of it here.
But, John, I wanted to talk to you about this absolutely magnificent new book you wrote, My New Orleans, the cookbook, 200 of my favorite recipes and stories from my hometown. And I guess the emphasis in the copy in the book is your hometown, right?
That's right. Well, I grew up just within eyesight of New Orleans, out in the country, so to speak, or what used to be the country is now is urban sprawl is slowly catching up with it. But always very interesting to me that this small culture that we have in and around New Orleans only exists within eyesight of the city. You know, you head too far north of the city and then you're in the south. You have to go north to go south. But too far north and you're in Mississippi, and too far the west and you're in Cajun country. You head too far to the south and you're in the Gulf of Mexico. And so really interesting that this indigenous cuisine exists only within just a few small square miles. And I wanted to write about it for some time, of how important I think that indigenous cuisine is. And not just the cuisine, but the culture itself gave birth to this incredible food and incredible music, which has made its way throughout the highways and byways into the soul of America.
This is not just a cookbook. This is your story. It's how the traditions surrounding the dishes. It's just like, how many books in one is it? A lot.
Probably too many, but I tell you what, just like restaurants, after the first restaurant, I swore I'd never open another restaurant.
How many do you have now?
Now we have 6 of them. But after writing this book, I thought, oh, Lord have mercy. This has been really an act of just trying to convey my soul in this book. I can't imagine ever trying to create another one.
Well,
so we've packed it full with as many great stories that really try to give you an insight to the people. And after all, it's really about the people. That's the reason why we're living here. We're not the most progressive lot on earth, but we do know how to entertain people. We do love people and love good times, and we waste as many of those times as possible around big pots of red beans and rice and gumbos and etouffees and all the things that, like the real food, the food that I grew up with. And that's what this book really pays tribute to, not the restaurant food, not the chefy trends, but the food of the people. And the expression of a people, the expression of that culture is found, the indelible ink of the recipes that have been passed down through generation.
Well, I have to thank you. As a matter of fact, I opened this feast days section and saw one of my family traditions where I haven't been able to put an appropriate recipe for. It's the cuchadada, which you call fig cookies.
Yes!
Well, I dug out my old Aunt Clara's recipe, and I don't know how many other family recipes. And I mean, you just can't believe what they're like. It's, first of all, they make like 34 dozen, and you can't cut the
well,
recipe.
Well, now you have a whole new recipe.
I do. I mean, it is. Except the only difference is we used a whole bottle of port.
Now something's been going on with this book, though, John, because you said it took you 5.5 years to complete it.
Well, it was an act of, you know, first started with creating these memoirs and these, just wanted to write down and record some of these stories of my childhood and also the stories that have been passed on to me, and the stories about people, about food, and about the role that people and food in this culture played in my life and still continue to play.
Tell us some of those stories, or tell us.
Well, here's the deal. I thought I would take these stories and just pass them on to somebody far more articulate than myself. Uh-huh. And have a co-author, and I took them to a good friend of mine, Dorothy Kalins, who I know that you've met in the past. She created Saveur magazine, and really kind of recreated the way we think about food and food photography and food journalism as a whole. And she said, "Johnny Boy, I'm not going to write this book. You're going to write this book. I'm going to be your editor."
Oh, see, that's great.
And so then she took it and handed it right back to me and said, "Johnny Boy, now let's get to work. This is what we're going to do." And she helped me really organize it into a whole, into an array of altogether 16 chapters, which really kind of signify the 16 months of my New Orleans calendar. In those months, you just talked about the feast days. You know, we're coming into the Mardi Gras season. We just left the Réveillon season. And so on Twelfth Night, we celebrate, you know, the beginning of Mardi Gras, or on the Three Kings Day. And so now we've started into the season. Believe it or not, our strawberries are already coming into season.
Really? Wow.
That quickly follows the Mardi Gras. You have strawberries, and you have crawfish, and then you have another chapter, which would be the feast days. You know, that's everything from St. Joseph's Day.
Yeah, well, that's what I was, that's the Cucinati,
okay,
so that's the Sicilian.
Also, there's a little note on our Creole Passover, and there's a note on the Creole celebration of Easter, and so it moves on throughout all these seasons, through the shrimp and the crabs and the oysters in the fall, and then the hunting season, which really isn't hunting season, but I call it gumbo weather. That's the time of the year that it cools down, and you start to crave those hearty dishes like the gumbos and the etouffees and things of that nature. And so I have stories that really relate to all that. Shrimp season, for instance. I kind of take you back to my first shrimping trip with my father and one of his friends. And these two would get in all sorts of trouble together. And one day they decide, look, we're just going to start shrimping part-time. Now, granted, both of these guys are airline pilots. They have master's degrees in mechanical engineering and know very little about the commercial shrimping business. But in their minds, look, if I'm not flying, and if I'll, we'll take our boats out and we'll catch shrimp and we'll go out and we'll sell shrimp. And it didn't take me long to realize that we weren't cut out for the shrimping business.
Oh, really?
Elbow deep in mud and muck in boat trying to sort out shrimp. And that's only because they didn't realize how to work the nets properly. And the truth is, you can cleat these nets off and speed up the boat to rinse all the mud and muck out of your nets. But my pop was too smart for that. He didn't know that. And so our commercial shrimping ventures didn't last very long.
Now, John, we know you're a hunter because the last time we were in New Orleans, which was Christmas time, a little more than a year ago, you were off hunting, so you do that.
I do that. I haven't progressed all that much. I love to hunt. I love to fish. And now the father of two boys, I can't believe I said that. The father of four boys.
Yeah,
I was thinking.
I thought maybe.
As a father of four boys, now I'm having so much fun taking my oldest two on the different hunting and fishing trips with me. The younger ones can fish, but they're not ready to face the marshes and go duck hunting in the early mornings. It's a bit arduous for them. But
no, we thought maybe
had the best time.
We thought maybe you'd lost two sons along the way.
No, two of them are at the age where they can start to go with daddy, and the other two are still a bit young.
Huh. Now, well, So what do you fish when you fish?
Well, we fish for everything from speckled trout to redfish to grouper to snapper to the bigger fish of the blue water. That would be the things like pompano and other fish like tuna. We have a number of, especially this time of year, this is some of the best tuna fishing, you know, in the some of the best tuna fishing in the world.
John,
right here at the mouth of the Mississippi River.
No, there's so many things about New Orleans that I didn't know, even though I've been going for years. And there are things that I didn't know about you, like you're such a big fan of Iron Chef.
Yes, well, I love that old. I love the show. I love the Japanese show. I thought the Japanese really knew how to do it right.
That was funny, wasn't it?
They come up with, you know, all of a sudden they, voila, here's the secret ingredient. And to see the, I love the fact that here's true artistry. And it doesn't matter who wins or loses because they can, I love watching a creative mind work. And I love to watch how these creative minds would, were masters of their own art. And you would see that through their beautiful presentations and their exquisite cooking techniques. And so, of course, I gravitated to that show. And back in the day, few people had access to it, and I would have cooks that would bring it in on video cassette tapes, and we would pass them around the kitchen, and man, one night I'll take one home, and another night we'll give it to somebody else, and we would come back and talk about it. And we'd have like little mini Iron Chefs in our own kitchen late at night when nobody was around, and just fell in love with that. And then when I was asked to actually participate with the on the Food Network's Iron Chef, that was just a feather in the cap. I thought, how great is that? Never will forget the one time, whenever you're on, you know, it might be, I don't know, 3 to 5 different ingredients that you know, you're liable to come across as the secret ingredient. And so you build contingency plans. And so one day came, I knew that one of my Iron Chef competitions, there was a possibility that I might cook live eels. And heck, we don't eat live eels around here. We don't eat dead ones, for that matter. So I had, outside of a Japanese restaurant, I hadn't had them before. And so I started contacting all of my shrimpers because we've got a ton of eels. We just don't eat a lot of them. And so all of a sudden, all my shrimping friends started bringing me 10-gallon buckets full of live eels covered with water, and we'd have plastic wrap over the top of them, punch in little holes, and I mean, yeah, these things are as ugly as the devil when you pick them up and they're hissing at you, and
really?
Then it's really quite complex to try to skin one and so on and so forth. And so we practiced for weeks on eating, on cooking and preparing in 7 different preparations all these eels. Well, I go there, I'm ready for my Iron Chef competition, and guess what? It wasn't eel. Eel wasn't the secret ingredient, and I just tortured my entire staff with eating eel every day for a couple of weeks.
Oh, that's so. Torture. That would torture me. I'm not we just got back from Valencia, and in the market, all the eels are alive.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then... buys them and you get the big cleaver. And
yeah,
so
they just cut the head off, and if you want it, flattened, you can. Otherwise, you can get a hole.
And right.
And the eel cellar is covered in eel blood from head to toe.
Yeah, I found it a little unattractive.
I feel bad for his wife or her husband, whoever the butcher has to.
Yeah, exactly. And then the snails. I thought that was funny. They were all alive and they were crawling away.
Oh yeah, there's been many times when we have our snails. You have to keep those snails covered up, and normally we keep them in a bucket, and we'll take
cornmeal.
We'll take some cheesecloth and over the top, and that way they have plenty of air and so forth. Well, if you don't really tie that thing off well, you're going to have eels from one end of your cooler to the next.
Snails
on more than one occasion.
What are a couple of the things in the book that you think are real highlights? I like the section on fish where you said you were fairly sure that your mother never shopped at a fish shop in her whole life.
No, I don't think my mom had ever fished in shopped in a fish shop. You know, if we weren't fishing, somebody else in the neighborhood was. And food to us is just such a, there's something very communal about it. And if you have it, you don't cook gumbo for, you don't cook two or three, four portions of gumbo. You cook a big pot of gumbo. You make that, and what you have left over, if you haven't invited somebody over, then you send some to your neighbor's house. If you, when we would buy shrimp, we would buy shrimp by the, at least the 50-pound little cooler. And, so we would take those, whatever you had left over that you weren't using, you would take to the lady next door. You would take to the man down the street and vice versa. And so we shared a lot between, you know, just around the neighborhood of, hey, and not to mention if you did buy shrimp, it was normally out of the back of somebody's pickup truck as they pulled into the neighborhood. They would know who to go to and say, look, I have some shrimp for sale, such and such a price, and you would, you know, take your cooler out to the street and you would just make that transaction there.
You talked about chefs actually going to jail for cooking.
We've had a couple of chefs in New Orleans.
Yeah, that's the,
that
you mentioned that. You mentioned
illegal
that.
Fish, and consequently, the day that they were arrested for buying illegal fish, only because it wasn't from a licensed fish purveyor. The restaurants that did that, you had a couple of them that weren't really doing all that well. Well, let me tell you what they were. That there's nothing better than to be arrested for selling fresh fish that you bought from the fisherman and going to jail for it, and all of a sudden you've just turned your whole restaurant around because he buys fresh but illegal fish, I'm going to his restaurant. I know for a fact it helped the stock of a couple of these restaurants in town which weren't doing so well until they got arrested for selling fresh fish purchased from the fisherman and not from the fishmonger.
Do you have another story you'd like to highlight, John?
I have stories for days.
I understand, but we're going to have to conclude our program before days are up.
I think the biggest thing is what I wanted to do is create a book that really exposed the soul of the people. And this is not a Sheppy book. And it seems like a contradiction for me promoting a book that wouldn't be a Sheppy book since I myself am Sheppy. But rather, this is, I think, very important to document the food of a culture, and a culture that we're really at risk every day. Is every day that this country so-called progresses, we tend to lose our regional and each urban area tends to lose that special culture, which at one time really was something of a distinction between, you know, one city or another. And as I've traveled praising and preaching all the great things about New Orleans in this book, it made me realize even more just how in danger we are of losing our indigenous American culture to this kind of pop culture phenomenon.
Yeah, it doesn't go well with Walmart either.
Yeah, it's the Walmart.
Well, the Walmartization of America. But
yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Let's face it. Heck, I don't know if we can ever reverse that. But what we better start doing is appreciating the chili, the Philly cheesesteaks of Philadelphia. Let's enjoy those deep dish pizzas of Chicago.
Have you ever had a pierogi?
Let's not lose those, you know?
Have you ever had a pierogi from Pittsburgh?
I've had many pierogis.
It's like swallowing rocks.
Yeah, and you live to tell the tale. Now, before we finish up, I want to take a 90-degree turn, because I read early in the book, you said there's a tension within John Besh. There's a tension between the traditional New Orleans, which you have a love affair with and which you talk about in this book, and then your own take on Louisiana New Orleans cuisine, which is decidedly more modern. So reflecting on that, now let's do a rundown of the latest boundaries of the John Besh empire and the modernized Creole cuisine that it serves. Can we do that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Go ahead, fire away.
Well, just to set the record straight, there had been a part of our restaurant community, not New Orleans in general, but a part of our restaurant community that I think had become stagnant, and that I wanted to break away from that. I saw what, through my experiences abroad, made me realize what I have at home. And my apprenticeship and my ability to work in other countries and in different cultures – made me appreciate even more of what we have, what's indigenous to us, in that I still want to cook. I don't want to modernize that gumbo. Gumbo, I think, is far more important than deconstructing. I think I don't want to modernize these master recipes, these great dishes that have been passed down, and that your pick of chefs, but Larry Forgione on the East Coast, of, look, let's renew farm to table. Let's see how far we can take this. Let's really why have we lost all of our truck farms across the country?
But, you know, the one drawback I found in your book is that you have access to these wonderful ingredients that I couldn't get close to.
Right, and do at certain times of the year. And people say, well, you know, heck, I'm asked all the time, well, I can't find raspberries at this time of year. And I said, well, don't use them. Right. Substitute what's in the book, whatever you have in your backyard. And
we don't have crawdaddies.
At this time of year, even in your neck of the woods, you've got cabbages and you've got turnips and you've got the root vegetables that people used to thrive on. And that's what we need to be eating. We eat with the seasons. And people have been doing this since the beginning of time, and only until just relatively, you know, only until recent times have we even thought about shipping foods from across the country and having things out of season, in season, and vice versa. So we've removed ourselves so far away from the farm and our source of food that we as Americans too often don't even know where our food comes from. And what I wanted this book to say is that, look, we all come from somewhere. Now, this is the somewhere that I come from. Understand the soul of its cooking and apply it to whatever ingredients you do have. Because no matter where you are in this country, even if you don't have okra, you can make a great chicken and sausage gumbo using your chickens and using your sausages.
Right. And, yeah. We're really fortunate in southwestern Pennsylvania. We have good lamb.
Sure.
Yeah, we have.
We're having lamb with root vegetables tonight for dinner.
And that's how we need to eat. That's a beautiful.
But John,
thing.
I'd rather be in one of your restaurants in New Orleans.
Well, trust me, I'd rather have you in one of my restaurants tonight.
Well, anyway, so John, the flagship is still your famous restaurant, August.
August, yes, sir. And then across the street, we have Best Steak.
Okay,
and
we went there too.
Yeah, and Luke.
Two blocks away, we have Luke, which is our Alsatian German brasserie.
We loved that so much. We went on Christmas Day for brunch, and we liked it so much, we went for dinner the next day.
I love it. And then we have Domenica, which is in the Roosevelt Hotel.
You know, what's that one like? I don't know that.
This is new. It's Italian.
Two blocks away, which you haven't been to yet because it just opened about 6 months ago.
Okay.
And then we have the American Sector, which is our 1940s diner inside the National World War II Museum, formerly known as the D-Day Museum. But now it's Congress has named it the National World War II Museum, and that has just been so much fun. And we have across the lake, we have La Provence, which you've been to before, and that's our farm-to-table restaurant that had previously, you know, for 40 years prior to me, been owned by my mentor, Constantin Caragiorgio, and a Frenchman with a Greek name from Provence.
Yeah, we interviewed the chef there. We had an absolutely wonderful time, and they said they had plans to start serving lamb, which they were growing right there.
Yeah, and so that's the lamb that we cook in that restaurant comes from either our farm or three neighboring farms next door.
And pork. Don't you have pigs, too?
And
we have lots of we have lots of pigs. Funny thing is, we're switching this week, actually. We're taking the rest of our pigs to harvest, working on our pens, and we have a fresh shipment of Wolfschwein, the woolly pigs of Austria, are coming here. And so
are they the ones that are really fatty?
We're going to experiment with woolly pigs.
Are they? They're fatty, right?
Yeah, the fat is supposed to be superior to the Berkshires that I've been raising.
Yeah, are we the funny
extinct? The hams are going to be a little smaller, which isn't such a bad thing, and the bacon will be a little bit thicker. And so it's just a different breed, and we love to play, and we are really excited about having our woolly pigs coming, and now we're just preparing for that, preparing for the boucherie.
Send me a woolly pig picture.
I will. You need to look it up. The a good friend of mine, Dave Matthews, the singer.
Oh, we were at his vineyard. He has a vineyard in
Virginia.
We were there.
Well, Dave turned me on to the woolly pigs, and I tell you what, that is some incredible pork. And so he and Ashley, his wife, have connected me with their woolly pig farmer, and so they're sending me a whole shipment of woolly pigs.
That's
so
funny.
I'll let you know how the woolly pigs turn out.
Well, fabulous.
The guy who owns Herb Farm, what's his name?
Love the Herb Farm.
Yeah, well, he's on Twitter with me, and he was talking about his woolly pigs.
He has woolly pigs.
And I said, are they smart? And he said, well, they can count to five, but they're not good at algebra. And I said, oh, they're of average intelligence.
Now, there's a guy called John Stewart. He and his wife own a restaurant called Zazu in Santa Rosa.
I love her. She's a doll. What's John's name?
John Stewart, and his wife's name is Dusky Estes.
Dusky.
Yeah.
And,
a
sweetheart.
Yeah, they have woolly pigs.
They have black pigs.
Yeah. No, they're woolly. They have woolly ones now. They were doing black ones. Now they're doing
black,
woolly ones.
Well, John, we could go on and on. We'll just have to hold ourselves down there.
But y'all, when you have a chance, please come down to see us.
Okay, John.
I'll see you about this time of year every year.
Yeah, man.
You're down in the winter generally. So.
Yeah, well, it's been so cold. We went to Rome for Christmas this year. It was really nice.
Next year, when the geese start to migrate, you need to follow them.
All right.
We'll do something like that.
In the meantime, I want to tell everybody to get this book. Go to New Orleans to taste your food and all your wonderful restaurants, but also John's book, My New Orleans, is just superb. And as you said, John, some people don't even read the recipes. They just read it as a book right front to
That's
back.
That's right. That's right.
And then cook later.
Well, y'all, thank you so much.
Thank you, John. And hope to see you soon.
I can't wait to feed you.
Thank you. Bye.
Take good care. Bye-bye.
Well, I'd like to be right there eating that food. But anyhow, it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We did a program on cheeses and cheese makers. And,
It was already a long program.
It was a long program. We had additional encounters of the cheese maker variety. And we interviewed them, and we have more information.
This is strange encounters of the cheese kind, huh?
Yes.
and Allison Hooper comes up next because she not only makes cheese, she also figures out how to use it in the kitchen.
And she really is the one who sparked this big surge in American artisanal cheese making with the American Cheese Society.
And people in the business thought enough of her product. Chefs in the business thought enough of her product. They agreed to participate in helping her write this book in a cheesemaker's kitchen. So here's Allison in the cheesemaker's kitchen.
I love people from Vermont. I'm not quite sure why, except they all tend to be extremely creative and pleasant. And certainly in that category is my favorite Vermont person, is Allison Hooper. Welcome to On the Menu, Allison.
Thank you.
Now, Allison, you have a new book out called In a Cheesemaker's Kitchen. And we've talked to you before because you have been president of the American Cheese Society. You helped start this whole artisanal cheese development in America. You co-founded a fabulous company. It's a company with a fabulous product, Vermont Butter and Cheese. What's the premise of this book?
Well, we're celebrating our 25th anniversary of business, and this was the perfect 25th birthday present that we could give ourselves. Really, the book has two goals. One is that even though we've been making these products, creme fraiche, chèvre, mascarpone, fromage blanc, cultured butter for many years, consumers still don't really know how to use creme fraiche in cooking. So we thought, well, let's put together a book and ask some of our wonderful chef customers to help us with some recipes and really give people an arsenal of recipes to make these terrific things.
Now, the chefs are all, they're all custom, they're all regular customers.
Yeah, yes, they are.
And some really famous people.
Yes, they are. And I suppose that is an advantage of having a creamery in Vermont, as we're close to Boston and New York. And when we started our business in the early 80s, there were a lot of French restaurants in New York. That was really the heyday for French cuisine in New York City. And because our product line is really based on French-style cheeses, it was natural for us to target those French chefs and cajole them into buying our product at the time. They were really wonderful, quite gracious, and as long as we made something that was as good as something they could buy from France, they were happy to buy local products.
Besides, you were a whole lot more convenient.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you listeners, you should also understand that Allison and her husband started this business when they were both about 12.
Yeah, it seems that way, doesn't it?
Well, I'm looking at the pictures. There's clearly something extraordinarily agreeable and non-aging about making goat cheese.
We're looking at this one picture. Did you go from being a brunette to a blonde?
Well, you know, women change their hair color every week. You know that, right? So,
but your partner in founding the company was not your husband per se.
That's right. It was actually Bob's wife, who he's still married to, Sandy, suggested that we start the business together. So,
Sandy
and
Reese.
So we have two families, and between us there are six sons. So
oh my! Oh dear, dear.
It's a true family business, which gives it a certain sort of interest in and makes it kind of unique, I guess.
Anyway, and you've won every prize imaginable.
Well, you know, when you've been around for two decades, you have an opportunity to win prizes.
Yeah,
come on.
you're being way too modest. But anyway, let's slide back to some of these chefs.
Okay.
Who have we got?
Well, gosh, we have Eric Repair from Le Bernardin. And before I tell you about these chefs, I should also say that when we had this idea of doing this book, we were kind of thinking, oh, wouldn't it be nice to have a book with wonderful recipes and great photography, and gosh, maybe we could even get a chef or two to give us a recipe. And we thought, well, these chefs are never going to share their recipes with us. They don't know. They know us as their vendor and their supplier of some products, but they wouldn't have any idea that we were going to come out with a nice book. And yet, surprisingly and really and fortuitously, they agreed instantly to help us with the book. And it was so gratifying to get that endorsement from them. They just sort of, I think they thought, gee, this is a company that has supplied us with such quality products over the years. It would only, of course, they're going to make a quality book. So we were so thrilled that they all signed on. Everyone that we asked said yes without hesitation. And so that would be Eric Repair from Le Bernardin. We have Michel Richard from Citronelle and Dan Barber from the Stone Barn and Raymond Ost from Sandrine's in Cambridge, Mass.
And that's the only place that we've not interviewed him, and I've never eaten there. But all the others are very well known.
Yeah, well, Sandrine's is a wonderful little French-style bistro in Cambridge, and his specialty is in Alsatian cooking. He's from Alsace, and of course, in our product line, we have a product called fromage blanc, which is which is used in this very traditional tart flambé that you would eat if you visited Alsace or Strasbourg.
Now, how did the recipes come? Now, are they truly the chef's recipes themselves? Anne was drooling over Eric Repair's
the goat cheese parfait.
Goat cheese parfait.
Yeah. Yep. Those are their recipes, and everything just sort of worked out. We wanted to have a chef recipe in each section of the book, so we had one in the salad section, the appetizers, and the main course. And for some reason, they all kind of picked the slot that needed to be filled, so it was meant to be. But
yeah.
Mireille, we also have a recipe from Mireille Gugliano, who is the author of of French women don't get fat. And
I tried that leek soup. Let me tell you, it was terrible.
You thought it was terrible?
I mean, how many days could you eat
that? Oh, how many days could you eat that? Yeah.
She lost a lot of weight because she was taking in no sustenance whatsoever.
That's right. And the pounds melted off of you, I'll bet. But Mireille is somebody that we really adored her book and her philosophy about food, and that Americans are so obsessed with dieting and so forth, and French women eat what they like and want, and they eat cheese and they have butter, and you know, they drink wine, and but they do everything in moderation, and they walk where they're, you know, they use the stairs. And so she has a wonderful sort of joie de vivre, if you will, in terms of how she writes about food. And
now the big issue is that even teenage girls in France and in Paris have cellulite.
Yes, that's right. And that's true. I must say, the last few times I've been to France, I've said, you know, they're not as skinny as they used to be.
They're catching up.
But, yeah, well, we've got McDonald's now in France, so maybe that's contributing to it. But anyway, so she was delightful in endorsing, if you will, in so many words, our fromage blanc and the products that we make. And so she agreed to help us develop this quiche recipe without the crust.
Uh-huh. Now, you surrounded the featured recipes from the featured chefs with recipes of your own, also using your products?
That's right. And really, it was a great collaboration of a number of people. In our company, we have some salespeople who were former chefs, and so they do a lot of cooking with the product. And I had some sort of regular recipes, and our operations manager, she's from France, and she did lots of research on what kinds of recipes we should develop and have in the book. So it took us 3 years from start to finish with the concept of the book. So we had plenty of time to test.
Now, there's only really one missing ingredient, because people can buy the book in a cheesemaker's kitchen from the On the Menu website and a number of other places. But, of course, there's an important ingredient in every single recipe, which is some kind of product from the Vermont Butter and Cheese Company. So before we sign off, how do people make sure they're getting just the right stuff?
Well, actually, it's great for people to use our cheeses, but all of these recipes are made with the types of products that can be substituted with other brands. If they have a very favorite fresh Chev or fresh goat cheese that they buy all the time from somebody locally, they of course can use those cheeses in these recipes, or a local creme fraiche, or if they like to buy Irish butter rather than butter from Vermont, which I can't even imagine, but there's certainly lots of substitutes that they can use. So,
let's be a little bit commercial.
Okay, so our products, they can be found in Whole Foods Market or Wegmans or Earth Fair. They can, if you go to our website and punch in your zip code, we may have a store near you where you can buy things.
Great. Okay, well, that's important. And that website is?
www.vermontcreamery.com.
I think you had a different one before.
We did. Yeah, we've done some rebranding since I was on the show and changed the company name from Vermont Butter and Cheese Company to Vermont Butter and Cheese Creamery.
Creamery.
Yeah, I think you were actually
that was more in keeping with what we do.
Yeah, so. I think you were actually in the midst of that rebranding the last time you were on the program.
Mm.
And listeners, let's be sure to say this before we leave you too. Many people are on the menu once. A much smaller number of people are on the menu twice, and we only invite them back if they're doing something really important and interesting.
Alison,
you certainly are doing that, and I hope you'll keep us posted on what you're doing. And I think Anne's threatening on trying to organize some kind of event in June in Vermont, which might give us the opportunity to meet in person for the first time.
Okay, well, we'll be there.
And we look forward to it.
It'd be fun.
Well, it's great to be back on. I appreciate the endorsement. It's really very great.
Well, you've witnessed the biggest transformation of cheese in the USA. I mean, you must be absolutely amazed when you look back to where you were.
I really am. Yep.
Max McCalman actually spoke about that in the interview that we did with him. He said he was absolutely thrilled at the number of high-quality entrants into the goat cheese section of a festival he just tasted.
Yeah.
I will give you a word from him. He did say, boy, I wish people were doing more with sheep. So if you're looking to diversify and get Max on your side as a spokesperson, get some lambs too.
Lambs. Yeah. Anyhow, what's next with cheese, do you know?
Well,
sheep's milk.
Well, there are a number of sheep's milk cheese producers here in Vermont. Their products are not as widely distributed, but they're awfully good.
Yeah, well, you've
and
lots
we
of
have
stuff
a Vermont Cheesemakers Festival. We had the first one last August, and our second is July 25th, 2010, at Shelburne Farms in Shelburne, Vermont. And
yeah.
If you're a cheese aficionado and have an interest in traveling to this culinary mecca of the United States, it's a fun weekend, and you'll meet wonderful artisans of local wine and cheese and breweries and chocolate and bread and all kinds of great food, and it's just a delightful
Well, send
time.
Us an email, and we'll put it up on our website.
There you go.
Announcing it. Allison, wonderful talking to you.
Great to talk to you, as always.
And hope to see you soon.
Okay.
Thanks, Allison.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now it's time for another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and we're talking yet again another segment about
now,
cheese.
Hold on a minute before we do that. After the first break, we forgot our usual thing about the first break, about asking listeners to get in touch with us and let us know how you like the program and what else you might like for us to cover and your opinions about this and that and the other kind of thing. And you
tweet
can
tweet and shout.
Yeah,
and
Facebook and do all
post.
That stuff. Yeah, and you can do that with a simple click right on our homepage, because there's a spot to do the various things, including actually sending us a good old common email, which we also like and which we reply to.
Who would ever think that emails would be sort of semi-old-fashioned?
Yeah, they're passé now. If you don't tweet, you're not with it, and Peter doesn't tweet, so he's not with it, but he's still here.
You can text, that's all right.
Now, back to cheese. Cheese of the cheddar variety.
Now, that's your,
But made 100 or so miles away from cheddar. Where the name comes from, but cheddar that comes from Wales, and cheddar that celebrates something rather unusual about Wales. So when you listen, you'll understand what I just said.
Tom Slattery of Global Sales and Marketing. You and I have been talking for a long time about cheeses, and today we're going to be talking about a Collier's cheddar, which is a very superb cheese. Welcome to On the Menu.
Well, thank you for having us on your show today.
Now, Collier's is an interesting name. We were just discussing that off the air, but tell us the story.
Well, the Collier's is known as the Collier's Powerful Welsh Cheddar. It's aged over 18 months. It has a very deep character to it, with crunchy bites to it, which are calcium lactose grains, which are developed during the maturation of the cheese. And after you're done chewing the cheese and tasting it, you have a slightly sweet aftertaste to it, which makes it a pleasant cheese tasting experience.
No, I was going more for the name itself.
Because
laughing, of course, there isn't really a, well, there probably is a person with a last name of Collier. Collier is really an occupation.
Right. It was named after the coal miners, of Wales, the Collier's cheddar.
Yeah, I would never, as a marketer, select this really grimy-looking coal miner to represent a fine cheddar cheese.
You got to look at what a coal miner is. A coal miner has power, integrity, strength, and it's reliable, and that's what this cheese has.
So that was the connection. So the people who've is it a company that's been around for a long time, Tom?
The producers have been around for quite a few years. We just start working within the last couple of years, and it's been a grassroots effort over in the UK, and we're bringing those grassroots efforts of getting the name of Collier's out over here in the USA.
And they just won a huge prize, huh?
Yes, they did. They took top honors. They won the gold medal in the International Cheese Awards this year
for the Collier's Powerful Welsh Cheddar for the best mature cheddar in these awards.
Now, this set of awards is the big world awards, right?
Yes, it is. This takes place right on their home turf over there in Nantwich, and they beat out a lot of their competitors there, and this was a big award for them to win this year.
Now, let's go through a couple of things here. I missed something along the way through. I wanted to let listeners know, just so that you learn the English language a little bit, always a good idea, that the reason colliers are called colliers is because they work in a colliery. And a colliery is a coal mine. So if you go to my native county of Yorkshire and you ask people where a coal mine is, they'll say, I don't know what you're talking about, because they don't have coal mines, they have collieries, and people who work in collieries are called colliers, which makes a whole lot of sense.
What about the tin miners in Cornwall? What are they called?
I don't know that. I don't know that they're extinct. there aren't any of them left. There aren't too many coal miners left in Wales either.
Yeah.
And I think there's been a trend going on for artisanal, regional, local kinds of products. Do you think the growth of colliers has something to do with that?
Well, I would think so. You know, this is a cheese that's not mass-produced, and the aging process, aged over 18 months to 20 months, shows that they will not put the cheese out before it's time to be put out. You know, there's a lot of cheddars that you find here in the U.S. that are aged 3 months to 6 months and lack the flavor profile that the colliers have.
Oh, sure. I did check it out the other day. I made some burgers for lunch, and I sliced up colliers, and I put it on top and put it under the grill, and it makes a mean cheese topping
for a good burger. Yeah.
It's really good. It would be great in grilled cheese sandwiches, too. Now, let's dispel a myth. Now, I can do this, or... Well, you can do this, Tom. You may be more qualified than me, being a real cheese hound. But cheddar is both a place and a style of making cheese.
That's correct. Cheddar has come from the UK, and it's a town, and it's also a type of cheese. So a lot of different cheeses get put into the cheddar category, and Collier's is probably at the top of that category with this flavor profile.
Key thing is real authenticity, right? A sticking to this is how cheddar's supposed to be made. Right. Top quality ingredients, aging for a sufficient period of time, so that it takes on the maturity that it needs to have.
What kind of cows does it come from?
Probably black and white ones, I should think. Most likely, probably Friesians or Holsteins.
Yeah, I think the Friesian cows that they come from.
Yeah, they're the white ones with black spots on them.
Okay.
As opposed to the black ones with white spots on them, or the red ones with white spots on them.
Yeah.
Now, you represent a number of other cheese producers as well.
Well, yeah,
Tom.
Before we leave,
Collier's,
why don't we ask how people get it?
Well, Collier's is over here. We've gotten into such great retailers like Whole Foods, Bristol Farms, Chinook's, AJ and Finer Foods, Harris Teeter, Albertsons in Southern California, Rouse's Supermarkets in Louisiana.
Do you have a store finder on your website?
We are about to add that to our website, and that will be key, you know, because retailers taste this. They're quickly to add this to their selection, so we'll be adding this to our website shortly, where to get Collier's at.
And your website is?
Our website is goglobalsales.com.
Okay, now
Peter's question.
Yeah, back into other cheeses. Do you specialize in cheeses from the UK?
Yes, we do. We bring in other cheeses from the UK as well. We bring in a wide range of cheeses, anywhere from Stilton to Gloucester to Stilton with Gloucester.
Is that the one they call the Huntsman?
The Huntsman, yes. Yeah. But you get that's a brand-specific item. There's a trademark on that, so we all can't call that.
But it's a similar style.
It's
pieces of, listeners, if you haven't seen it, it's pieces of usually blue vein cheese inset into a conventional cheddar-y kind of a yellow cheese on the outside. It's very attractive.
It looks good on a cheese plate.
So it's good for that purpose. It's good for novelty cheese eaters rather than real cheese eaters.
We really like Stilton.
Right. Well, we have a great Stilton. The people that make our Stilton is Webster's in if you go into London, you'll find Harrods and all the other top retailers there. They really, I've been fortunate enough to visit them as well, and they really take pride in their cheese making, you know. And
so this is a name like Colton Bassett, which is another one that's
right,
supposed to be at the top of the game.
Yes.
And then you've got another entry at a slightly lower price point, but slightly lower quality, coming from someone like Neil's Yard at Burramarga. I'm guessing that they wouldn't be quite the same premium level as the ones you represented
right,
here.
Yes, they're all great cheeses, but we think ours, with the awards they've won and everything else, stand a little above where they're at.
Great. Now, do you do other countries as well, like France and Italy and Spain?
Well, we import cheeses from Denmark, Germany, Holland, Ireland, Spain, Switzerland.
You are an importer, specifically.
Well, we're an importer agent partner with a lot of European cheesemakers that don't have a way of getting their cheese here to the U.S.
Let me give you a tip. Another place to go to find some absolutely wonderful cheeses is Australia.
That's what I've tasted many